May it please the court, I'm Shelley Thompson, Colorado Registration Number 39999. Good morning, Your Honors. Summary judgment was improper in this case, most importantly because appellants were denied any discovery. It was also improper because there were material issues of fact present and because appellants were denied an opportunity to amend a pleading. All of those issues on appeal revolve around two claims or defenses of appellants. One is whether Summit Bridge had an agreement with the FDIC under which it was required to service the lines of credit that are at issue in this case.
Counsel, I want to ask you about that agreement. Because frankly, I'm having a hard time getting my head around this idea. Because it appears to me that what your clients are saying is that by promising to have a lender who would, quote, service the notes, that your clients could borrow money, not pay it back, and continue to borrow more money without any recourse by the bank.
Judge Jones, thanks for asking that question. That is not our position. To service the loans in agricultural lending, which is an issue on which my clients submitted affidavits in their 30 years of history as a farming partnership, to service a line of credit, in their experience, meant to renew an annual line of credit. You go to the bank once a year, you pay it down as much as you can, and if the bank agrees that that's enough, then they renew it another year. And it's that line of credit on which you operate.
Right,
as a
farmer. But here...
And so servicing meant, in this case, renewing an annual line of credit. They had never made late payments on the loan. They had never made late payments in their history of a partnership prior to New Frontier Bank being taken over by the FDIC. At that point, or sometime between then and the time that Summit Bridge purchased the loans from the FDIC, they became in default on the loans.
So they didn't make payments. And you're saying they, nevertheless, despite defaulting, not paying back the money, the bank had an obligation to renew the loan. That's contrary to the express terms of the loan agreements and the promissory notes.
Yes, Your Honor. During that period, and the timeline looks like this, New Frontier Bank was taken over by the FDIC in April of 2010. And in the months that followed that, the Sidwells made an offer to the FDIC to purchase their own loans. They were still current with their loans for, I don't recall the amount, but 60 or 70 cents on the dollar. And it was sometime, between that summer and September, early September of 2009, I think I said 2010, that Summit Bridge purchased the loans in September of 2009. So, yes, at some point, Your Honor, you're correct. They did miss at least one payment. I don't know the facts well enough to know whether they missed more than one payment or two payments. But I do know that in their 30 years of history, they had never missed a payment on a loan and had outstanding credit. So when Summit Bridge purchased their loans in September of 2009, the Sidwells began negotiating with Summit Bridge directly to try to come to an agreement and pay off the loans or have them renewed, which is what the Sidwells believed, according to the representations that the FDIC had made, was what was going to occur. And it was very clear very quickly that it wasn't clear until later that to the Sidwells that the Summit Bridge didn't intend to renew the loans. And this action, the underlying action, was filed in December. I believe, let me make sure I get that date right. Yep, December 18th, 2009. So obviously at that point, any negotiations that had taken place had fallen apart and Summit Bridge was seeking replevin and judgment. So our position is that although we haven't had discovery on this issue, that the FDIC made statements to the farmers in the area that the New Frontier Bank loans would not be sold to any entities that weren't prepared to service them. Now, the distinction between service and renew was raised in by Summit Bridge in its reply brief, reply on summary judgment, which was one of our arguments on appeal, and that is that in the Keller case, this court ruled that an argument that's new in a reply brief is reason to reverse a summary judgment decision. So whether service meant renew is a factual issue. My clients say that service does mean renew in this instance in agricultural lines, 1 year lines of credit. And that was an issue that I think there is a material issue of fact on, and an issue that my clients never got to be heard on.
But was that issue raised in the initial affidavit that was submitted in opposition to summary judgment, or was it not until the motion to reconsider?
The issue was first raised by Summit Bridge in their reply on summary judgment, and then it was one of the subjects of appellant's motion to reconsider.
Right. So your client did not submit evidence that renew and service are the same thing until the motion to reconsider.
That's correct.
Okay. And what legal authority is there for the proposition that you can submit new evidence after summary judgment's been entered that's not newly discovered? It's evidence that existed all along but simply wasn't presented.
Again, Your Honor, the first time that anyone had ever raised the issue of whether service means renew is in the reply brief of Summit Bridge, which was filed just days before Judge Moss granted Summit Bridge's summary judgment motion. So the Sidwells had no opportunity to respond at that point. They raised that issue in the motion to reconsider and asked for, you know, not only an opportunity to respond, but asked for the court to reconsider its judgment.
So what is the disputed issue?
That is the disputed issue. I'm sorry?
What is the disputed issue of material fact then?
On that issue?
Well, I thought that was your position.
Before that, so the two claims or defenses that all of the issues on appeal revolve around was one, the FDIC, an alleged agreement between the FDIC and Summit Bridge that it would service the loans and not seek judgment or seek to liquidate the Sidwells, and two, a Regulation B defense, which has to do with whether it was proper in the first place for New Frontier Bank to ask the Sidwells wives to sign guarantees on the loans. As to the FDIC issue, I would like to bring the court's attention to three important facts on that issue. They're all in the record. One is, again, the meetings that the FDIC held in which it assured farmers that it wasn't selling their loans to an entity that couldn't service them. And two, the timing on that, which is that the loans had not matured at the time that New Frontier Bank took over, that the FDIC took over New Frontier Bank. The loans had not even matured when Summit Bridge purchased them in September of 2009. So those two facts put together, you know, could provide a defense of the Sidwells to the judgment altogether.
So the timing is the initial bank goes under, the FDIC takes over, the FDIC tells farmers that it's intending to sell to lenders who will service the loans. After that, your clients default. Is that the timeline?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't know the precise day that they defaulted, but I believe that is the timeline. And then shortly thereafter, Summit Bridge purchased the loans, and the loans still had not matured.
So what would be the defense to the default? I'm having a hard time understanding this.
Well, theoretically, if there's a written agreement somewhere between the FDIC and Summit Bridge, the defense would be that the loans hadn't matured. And so that, you know, that would be...
Even though the terms of the loans didn't change?
I'm sorry?
I'm not following. Your clients assumed they weren't obligated to continue making payments?
I don't want to speak to what my clients assumed. I don't think they assumed that, but They were under.
Oh, you said they were in default, so at some point they stopped making payments.
And I believe, maybe I can answer the question if I look at the records. Prior to my rebuttal, I will try to find the time in which they defaulted so that I can better answer.
Ms. Thompson, what do you mean by the loans had not matured?
They were scheduled to mature in one of them in December 2009. I think that was the largest one, 1.2 million. The other in March of 2010, and another in December 2014. One of them, I think it was a $100,000 loan, may have matured prior to that, but they were all scheduled to mature after Summit Bridge purchased them, and even I believe Summit Bridge filed the instant motion in front of Judge Moss's court right after the largest one matured.
But once there's a default, accelerated in nature.
I believe the terms provide that. The third issue I did want to raise on that point is, or the third fact, is that Justin Sidwell stated in his affidavit found on page 358 of the record in paragraph 24C that he believed discovery would contain Summit Bridge's due diligence or evidence that Summit Bridge knew, had actual knowledge that the property it was seeking in Judge Moss's court included property that was not collateral on the loan, such as cattle owned by the Sidwell's adult children and other non-partnership assets.
Also, there were several months between the Rule 26 disclosures and summary judgment here, during which I gather there were no discovery requests submitted by your client to anybody. What is their excuse for that?
Again, Judge Jones, thank you for the question. I think it's a very important one. The timeline on that is very important. The initial disclosures were provided by Summit Bridge in that case on April 14th, 2010. My client, my firm, entered an appearance on behalf of the Sidwells 2 weeks later on April 28th, 2010. And then a few days later, the Summit Bridge filed an adversary case in the bankruptcy proceeding, again, seeking to liquidate property the Sidwells say is not collateral on this loan. In connection with both that proceeding and Judge Moss's case, my law firm spoke with Mr. Marcus's law firm and asked for the due diligence on the loan. Summit Bridge's initial disclosures stated, and I quote, that it was producing all documents related to the FDIC's taking over New Frontier Bank as receiver and offering for sale and selling the Sidwell Brothers loans to Summit. Yet, its disclosures did not contain its due diligence on the loans. And when we had a conversation about it, Summit Bridge stated that they refused to produce those due diligence documents. That was in the interim. So then
so where were the discovery requests?
2nd, 2000.
Subpoena.
On June 2nd, 2010, so 1 month after our entry of appearance and 1.5 months after those initial disclosures, that's when Summit Bridge filed the motion for summary judgment that's at issue before this court today.
Should not preclude filing discovery requests.
You're correct, Your Honor. We had 1 to 1.5 months to not only propound discovery, but we would have also had to litigate a motion to compel because we already knew that Summit Bridge wasn't going to produce the due diligence, which is where these claims and defenses lie.
You didn't even try.
You're correct, Your Honor. I concede to the court that we were busy defending liquidation of the Sidwells on multiple fronts, so we let a month pass without propounding discovery. However, I would like to point out that Summit Bridge has not cited a single case before this court which supports the notion that 1 month or 1.5 months is ample time for discovery prior to a finding on summary judgment, or that it somehow constitutes undue delay.
It seems to me, though, first of all, we're talking about 3 months. I mean, you got the disclosures, and you say we didn't get all the information the disclosures said we were going to get. And then there's no discovery request for 3 months. And I know you came on in late April, but there was a law firm before that, and they have responsibility too.
They didn't serve any discovery. It was not 3 months. It was April 14th were the initial disclosures, and this motion was filed June 2nd. So it was a month and a half.
Well, the filing of the motion has nothing to do with your ability to seek discovery, though. It's not like, they filed a motion. We can't ask for discovery. That doesn't happen. I mean, you had over 3 months until the motion was granted. Surely, if you had at least served some discovery requests or subpoenaed some documents from the FDIC or from somebody, you could have gone into court with your 56F motion and said, we're trying. Give us some time. We're trying. But you couldn't say that.
You're right, Judge Jones, in that if you look at it that way, it was approximately 3 months. Again, Summit Bridge hasn't cited a single case where that amount of time would would support a finding of summary judgment with no discovery or would constitute undue delay.
You can get discovery without even filing you can get summary judgment without even filing an answer before 26 disclosures. You can, if I get a complaint filed against me, I can move for summary judgment immediately. The rule says at any time, and parties frequently do. I mean, the fact that discovery hasn't been conducted doesn't mean you can't get summary judgment.
But in this case, Your Honor, in the pleadings that were before Judge Moss, the Sidwells identified specific things that they thought the discovery would provide on these two claims and defenses that I just spoke of. Very specific things and reasons they thought that, you know, where the documents were and what they might say, and that they wanted to have an opportunity to discovery. I don't think there's any case law to support a finding of summary judgment without discovery in an instance like that. And I believe my time's up. Do you have any questions?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is James Marcus of the law firm of Marcus Williams, Young & Zimmerman, RID number 25065. I'm appearing today as counsel for the appellant, Summit Bridge Credit Investments. Your Honor, this appeal... Sorry about that. This appeal stems from a breach of contract action commenced by the appellant on December 18th, 2009, against the appellees, the Sidwells, as well as their general partnership called Sidwell Brothers Partnership. On February 17th, approximately 2 months later, the partnership filed for bankruptcy under Chapter 11. Subsequently, in the partnership's bankruptcy case, a Chapter 11 trustee was appointed by the bankruptcy court for cause. That decision is set forth in the record. The claims at issue in this case now focus on the underlying promissory notes and related guarantees and the entry of judgment against the individuals. On March 2nd, the appellees filed their answers, essentially admitting the indebtedness. There's no dispute as to the existence of the notes, the guarantees, or the amount of the debt. It is undisputed with respect to the four promissory notes at issue. Each of the four notes had the exact same signature block. It said Sidwell Brothers Partnership, then it had four separate signature lines. Each signature line said Gerald Sidwell, comma, partner, Justin Sidwell, comma, partner, Terry Sidwell, comma, partner, and Linda Sidwell, comma, partner.
Mr. Marcus, I want to ask you about that because that gets to the Reg B issue. Other than the promissory notes themselves, what does the record show? What documents the bank had in its possession at the time of the loans that would indicate that the wives were partners?
Yes, Your Honor, the record contains both the four separate promissory notes, three separate modification agreements to the notes, where the indebtedness, the principal date, had been extended by agreement of the parties. And then, Your Honor, most importantly, there were some other important documents, one of which is a document called Partnership Agreement for Sidwell Brothers Partnership. That's the heading of the document. It's signed by all four individuals. Each name is on the document. And the exact verbiage of that document states, and I'm going to quote, Sidwell Brothers has agreed upon adding Linda Sidwell and Terry Sidwell to said partnership. That's in the record at page 384. Your Honor, there is also an executed authorization form, which is a detailed two-page form certifying that each of the partners of the partnership included Linda Sidwell, Terry Sidwell, Justin Sidwell, and Gerald Sidwell. It also specified that each of those individuals were then not only partners, but they were authorized to act on behalf of the partnership agreement. This document is dated December 27, 2007, the same date as the first promissory note at issue. This authorization document also appears on the record in page 385 and 386. So in totality, Your Honor, we have four promissory notes, three modification agreements, an agreement that states, signed by the claimants or the appellants, that they are partners, and then you have an authorization which certifies they are partners and that they're authorized to act. The totality of those documents certainly suggests that it was represented to New Frontier Bank that Terry and Linda Sidwell were general partners of the partnership. And it appears that there is not any dispute in the case law that if Terry and Linda Sidwell were actually general partners as represented to the bank, there would be no Reg B violation because they were joint applicants. And in our pleadings, we've referenced a number of cases that discuss the notion of joint applicants and the fact that the Reg B defense is not applicable to joint applicants, but rather the Reg B defense applies where credit, or rather where the guarantee is required solely because the spouse is the spouse of an applicant. Here, everything is to the contrary. Now, I'd also note that the evidence also suggests that the one affidavit that was placed of record by Justin Sidwell expressly states that all of the financial statements that were provided to the bank were joint statements of the husbands and spouses. So there's absolutely no evidence of any kind to suggest that New Frontier Bank was asking for spousal guarantees solely because Terry and Linda were the wives of an applicant. In fact, everything suggests to the contrary. The only thing of record is an affidavit with the self-serving statement, which is essentially a general denial, that New Frontier Bank required spousal signatures. Your Honor, under the Allen standard, once we established the absence of a genuine issue of material fact, the burden then shifted to the Sidwells to establish specific facts to support their defense. In this case, they have not met that burden as found by the trial court. In fact, Your Honor, I think it's noteworthy that this entire Reg B defense in this issue of the alleged contract had never been pled by the defendants, ever. It was not in their answer. They filed an answer. Their answer listed five separate affirmative defenses, none of which included Reg B, none of which included an alleged oral contract. That only came up for the first time after Summit Bridge filed its motion for summary judgment. Your Honor, again, if I may go back to some of the background that the court was inquiring about, the record clearly shows that prior to the sale of these notes, the FDIC was appointed as the receiver for New Frontier Bank as part of the failure of New Frontier Bank, and that there's no dispute that these notes were in default prior to any sale. The record reflects that the sale occurred on September 3rd, 2009. That's set forth in the affidavit on page 327. The affidavit also indicates that the first loan for $1,200,000 became due and owing by its terms on December 1st, 2009, that this action was not commenced until 3 weeks or roughly 17 days thereafter. The record also reflects, unopposed, that the Sidwells were in fact in default on account of their promissory notes, and that the record shows that the FDIC on August 3rd sent four separate default notices for each of the promissory notes to the Sidwells. That's found in the record on page 372 to 383. So let's focus on what happened. The loans were in default. They're in default because the Sidwells elected not to make a payment. The loans were then sold. The Sidwells counsel discusses alleged settlement discussions for which there's essentially no evidence. Assuming that that's true, there still is no defense as to why the loans weren't paid when they were fully matured. The only defense being offered, which is raised again for the first time in the response to the motion for summary judgment, is that there's an alleged agreement to service loans. There's no documents to support this alleged agreement to service loans. In fact, there's no evidence. There's just evidence of one of the Sidwells that a non-party to this case told them that the FDIC was going to sell loans to a party that would service loans. As the trial court found, the defendants did not provide any evidence or provide any documentation asserting that the purchaser of loans would renew lines of credit, because that's essentially the argument. We want to take the leap of faith that there's some general statement that there's a service obligation, that we're going to sell loans to a lender who services loans. There's no dispute that Summit Bridge is a lender. It was qualified. It sold the loans. It was a qualified purchaser, at least in the eyes of the FDIC. But there's then this leap of faith that says, well, it doesn't matter what our performance was. It doesn't matter if we were in default. And in fact, it doesn't matter that we converted $540,000 of livestock for our personal use. You should have renewed the loans. And again, Your Honor, when I'm talking about that conversion of livestock, that's found in the record in Judge Brown's decision for the appointment of a trustee in the bankruptcy case.
That's not an order.
Yes, we did attach it to the motion. So,
it's a finding, I don't know the extent to which it's a binding finding on us, or which it's really evidence of a conversion.
Your Honor, you said it's correct. It may not be binding from the court, but it's exemplary of the idea that the notion that a lender would service is somehow obligated to renew, irrespective of any criteria of the creditworthiness of the underlying borrowers. In fact, there's absolutely no evidence in the affidavits or any kind to suggest the Sidwells were qualified applicants for renewal of the loans. None. The only evidence is an assertion that they never were in default prior to the failure of New Frontier Bank. There still is no evidence and no basis in the record for why they were in default once New Frontier Bank was taken over by the FDIC, or why they will continue to be in default after the loan was sold. However, they expect the court and the parties to then take the leap of faith that any party should have renewed the loans under any scenario. There's no allegation of the criteria. Essentially, they're arguing there was some verbal agreement to modify a contract, but there's no allegation as required under the Allen case of the terms, the specific facts by which there is a dispute. There's just a generic allegation that these loans were to be sold. That does not meet the standard under Rule 56 and under the Allen decision. Your Honor, I'd also like to talk a little bit about the court's inquiry about discovery, because I think it's very relevant. As the court noted, discovery opened on August 14th. The case had been on file since December 17th.
April 14th.
I'm sorry, April 14th. I apologize, Your Honor. And it's important to note that Summit Bridge made its initial disclosures. That's of the record on page 178. I'm going to read some of the items that were specifically identified. Promissory notes and security agreements, guarantee agreements, credit applications, financial statements, partnership agreements, balance sheets, field inspection reports, appraisals, memoranda related to the loans at issue, miscellaneous documents generated in connection with the loans of the issue. The initial disclosures then state, copies of the foregoing documents are available for inspection and copying at the Office of Counsel for Summit Bridge during normal hours upon reasonable notice. There's nothing in the record to suggest any efforts were ever made to compile these documents. In fact, there is no reason offered why they never even bothered to come get the documents. Now, there's an assertion by counsel that a request was made. There's no documents to support that. There's no evidence of the record to support that allegation. My recollection does not coincide with that. But again, under these circumstances, it was proper for the court to deny the request under Rule 56F. There was an adequate opportunity. They chose not to avail themselves. Unless the court has any further questions, I have nothing else to add.
Thank you, counsel. Yes.
Thank you, Your Honors. The first thing I take issue with is Mr. Marcus's mischaracterization of Sidwell's $540,000 of livestock net conversion never occurred. They are honest and creditworthy people. But back to the legal issues in the case, on the Reg B issue, Mr. Marcus stated that that the wives and husbands submitted joint financial statements. Well, Reg B on its face states, a creditor shall not deem the submission of a joint financial statement or other evidence of jointly held assets as an application for credit. The Sidwells submitted the partnership agreement itself, which states that Jerry and Justin Sidwell are the only partners in Sidwell Brothers Partnership. K-1s, which were submitted with every tax return, which stated that Jerry and Justin Sidwell were the only owners of Sidwell Brothers Partnership, 50-50 owners. And thirdly, affidavits, where they say their wives had never been partners in the partnership. The agreement that was entitled partnership agreement or amendment to partnership agreement that Mr. Marcus refers to was given to the Sidwells by New Frontier Bank after the third of these four loans. And as a result, it wouldn't apply to the first three. And on the contrary, I think it supports the position that New Frontier Bank knew that the wives were not partners in Sidwell Brothers Partnership.
Well, counsel, did your clients sign those documents?
My clients did, in connection with the third loan, did sign that.
All right, so they signed documents telling a bank in connection with a loan that these are the four partners. And now they say two of the partners that we said you were partners were not and never have been partners. That sounds pretty dicey, counsel.
Judge Jones, they didn't say that they were partners. If you look at the signature block on the promissory notes that Mr. Marcus refers to, it's not entirely clear that they are stating to a financial institution that they are partners in this partnership.
It said partner right next to their name.
In at least one of the promissory notes it does, and they vary.
Well,
so, you know, each promissory note looks a little bit different. But like
but
I
they
said,
did.
My point, Your Honors, is that there's a material issue of fact as to whether these wives were partners in this partnership.
That's not the material issue, it seems to me. The material issue is what the bank thought. I mean, because it's the bank's state of mind. If the bank has information from your own clients indicating that those four people are partners, that's what's relevant.
And Your Honor, the Sidwells could have probably submitted testimony by a New Frontier Bank officer confirming that he knew that the wives were not partners in the agreement. That's why he had them sign a document at the time of the third loan. So we had already gone through $1.5 million worth of loans, that kind of to correct the Reg B issue, if you will, for the bank's files that stated, yes, I'm a partner to the agreement, and the wives signed it. All of that should have been, the Sidwell should have been allowed to put this in their pleadings, to get discovery on it, and to raise the Reg B defense through evidence.
Counsel,
thank you.
Thank you.
This case is now submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.